And good afternoon. Scott Spears back with you here on this Thursday, sunny so far. Sunny Thursday, July the 20th, 2017. 15 minutes past 1 o'clock, coming up on 16 minutes. And you are tuned into the Now program here, hopefully having a great time. This hour, we are going to get to talk to somebody who I have wanted to have on the show for quite some time. We've had a lot of great people. Dear Abby has been on the show, and Heloise has been on the show. And when it comes to etiquette, over the last 100 years, the name that comes to mind is that of Emily Post. Today, we are lucky enough to be joined by the great-granddaughter of Emily Post, Lizzie Post. Lizzie, how are you?
Hello! Thank you so much for having me, and I never like doing this, but I have to start off with, I'm so sorry I am, like, late to our interview.
No,
I would
no,
have liked to have started at our start time. I apologize.
No, it's okay. I was worried. I thought, oh boy, I hope there's not somebody else on the line and I'm giving the introduction. But no, I'm glad we finally connected because the name Emily Post has been around for a lot of years. And what I found in preparing for... It's interesting that we started out with etiquette in an interview about etiquette. It's fascinating.
Right? I swear I don't do that on purpose.
No, that was perfect. That was perfect. Everybody knows the name Emily Post, but what I have found is that a lot of people don't know what it means.
Just the phrase, like Emily Post to do or something
Was somebody who was important.
Yes. I will say that while we are really thrilled to be in a fifth-generation family business, our brand's been around. Emily started writing in 1922, so we're like 95-year-old brand publishing on etiquette. And it's interesting to see that, you're right, that so many people kind of do know the name, but at the same time, there's also this almost disconnect, like it's all of it is from a bygone era or something. And I would like to say, it couldn't be further from the truth, as long as people are interacting, there will be etiquette to talk about.
What is a good, not a dictionary definition, but what's a good definition for etiquette?
Well, that's a great question. Really, whenever you have two people come together and their behavior affects one another, you have etiquette.
And has our etiquette gotten better in the last 95 years or worse?
I think that you will find if you ask people 20 or 30 years ago if times are ruder and civility is lost, they would say so. And if you asked the generation before that, I feel like we always look back nostalgically and we say, oh, our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation, that's when life was good. That's when things were perfect. That's when people were polite and there was common decency. We all say that about every generation. So I think that it's just very normal for us to look at our current generation and our current circumstances and say, these are terribly rude times we're living in.
How did Emily Post get started? How did that all come about?
Oh my God, that's a very long story. I will try to keep it very short and say that she was, interestingly enough, as a woman in the early 1900s, she actually was an author. She wrote basically romance novels, and eventually she divorced her husband because he was cheating on her, and it's a fabulous story. If you haven't checked out the book yet, check out Laura Claridge's guide, biography. It's called, I believe, Daughter of the Gilded Age, Mistress of American Manners, and it's Emily Post biography. It's not done through our company, but she was fabulous, and it really details the story. But she was basically asked by her publisher to write a book on etiquette, to which she said, that's ridiculous, you don't want me doing that, this is silly. And she kind of started making some notes on the topic, and the next thing you knew, she had a 627-page book. And that's really how it started.
And it took off, and she became the grand dame of etiquette.
She did. She really focused on practicality, and all of Emily Post etiquette is based in consideration, respect, and honesty, or an upholding of a tradition. And we really try to look at the traditions and see whether they serve us or whether there's a better way to do them now, and you might choose to do something as a nod to tradition, and you might choose to break tradition, so we talk about the etiquette of that. But most all of the etiquette issues that we experience can really boil down to thinking about the people around you and being aware of them, and being aware of how your actions or the actions of the, you know, the potential outcomes of a situation, how they're going to affect all of the players involved in that situation. And then really moving forward honestly by saying, this is going to be the best solution for everyone involved. And that's really what all of our etiquette boils down to. It's not do it because we say to do it. It's not do it because our great-grandmother said to do it. It's really, how does this work for all the people involved in this type of situation?
I want to run down some issues that I don't think would have happened in Emily Post day, but they happen today, and find out what in the world we should be doing.
Sure.
And the one that comes up a lot that I see,
yeah,
is people, especially in summer, we're here in an Ohio summer, hot summer,
yeah,
sometimes people are dressed a little inappropriately. Should we say anything?
I think relative terms. You're inappropriate. This is where it gets dicey about saying things to people. First of all, you have to look at your standing with this person. Who are they? Are they a stranger on the street? Are they, you know, a child in your community? Or is this person an elder to you? I think you really need to look at what standing you have to be making judgments about other people's clothing and personal choices of expression. I would say that if you encountered, let's just say that there was too much skin showing, and you saw a person coming down the street, and there was definitely more skin showing than you would like to be looking at, then rather than scold the person for what they are wearing, which would be inappropriate for you to do, you're a stranger to them, you would turn your attention elsewhere. You know, you really do want to ignore that. This is a stranger, and there's no law against what they're doing, I'm guessing, and there's no place for you. You're not their parent. You're not their boss. Therefore, it's really important that you not scold them or try to reprimand them for their choice of attire.
The big one, I'm out to dinner with somebody, and they cannot put their phone down or keep looking at it.
That one you can speak up about, and I would probably say something like, Jeff, I totally understand how often I can want to check my phone, but do you think we could have a phone-free evening tonight? That's not the best sample language, but I would say it's okay for you to ask for the person's attention. Some people choose to go about that by saying, oh, do you need to go take that call, or would you like to step out to the lobby? I tend to find that language is a bit of a put-down. I think it's like a little bit assuming and pushy. Instead, I might just clearly ask for what I would like, which is, you know, I would love it if we could have this be a phone-free meal.
Somebody brought this up the other day. They said that now people are ending relationships through text messages and emails. Is that proper etiquette?
I think everyone who's been through a breakup knows that sometimes that just happens to be the end of communication, whether it was intended or cowardly used as a way to break up with someone. I think that sometimes it can be good to see things in clear black and white print or whatever color was chosen, whatever font color was chosen. But I would say that it's probably better to have that phone conversation or that face-to-face conversation. You can express so much through your tone and your facial expressions and your presence with somebody that I think the more you can have those cues around to convey that, you know, this is over and it's okay that it's over, or that, you know, this is just how it has to be, I think that's always the best case scenario. Sometimes, for safety reasons, you might want to do something through email, or via text message or something like that. So in today's society, it's not one size fits all. It's what's your situation, and how can we best think about the people involved in it.
This question came up for me last year at Christmas time because we used to do a big thing with Christmas cards. And last year, maybe 2 years ago, for the first time I started to get Christmas card emails. Should I respond to that? I mean, usually it was you get a Christmas card, you send one back. But do I have to email them back a Christmas card?
Well, I think more so it's, and I don't know, maybe things are different in Ohio. I know in Vermont we tend to just make our Christmas card list and send it out. And
used to be.
Some people might purchase extras to then send one in kind, you know, like in reply if they needed to. But for the most part, you just create your list and send it. And if you didn't send someone one, but they sent you one, it's really okay. It's not meant to be a reciprocal thing. Some years you might choose to participate, some years you might not. So when it comes to an email version of that, I would just send out my email and I'd read the ones that I receive. And if I felt like sending one in reply, I would. But I think more so, it's just simply, it's almost like a family newsletter. Like you don't reply to it typically.
A lot of people have given up the art of letter writing. When should I write somebody a handwritten letter?
That's really up to you. It's really your choice. We always say don't write an angry letter. So that would be a time I would not choose to do so. But, I mean, letters are beautiful things. They're really nice to receive in the mail. I think you want to be realistic in thinking about response and reply and even receipt, knowing that it was delivered. Not everyone is going to reply to your letter in kind. I think you should just, if you do choose to send a letter to someone, that's just a social letter saying, hi, how are you? Here's what's going on in my life. What's going on with you? Then I would be wary that people don't do this as much anymore. And so a reply might take quite a long time to come if it comes at all.
And a huge one that everybody faces at some point or another, tipping.
Oh my goodness. Americans have created the most complicated tipping system ever because we have different tipping norms in different areas, and there are different types of service people that we tip and different types of service people that we don't tip. And so I think it's very complicated. Let's narrow it down, shall we?
Well, what if the service is, I'm in a restaurant,
okay,
and let's say my meal costs $20,
okay,
and the food was bad.
If the service is great and the food is bad, I would still be tipping between 15 and 20%, and I'd be speaking to the manager, because the manager, what they might do is discount your meal or remove it entirely. But even if someone removed my meal entirely, I would still leave that 15 to 20% tip. You never, ever, ever want to make the servers or the wait staff as a whole, especially if they pool tipping, be punished for food that wasn't good. They don't make them prepare the food. Now, there might be an issue of your food was cold or overcooked, and that's because it was sitting too long. But again, if it's an issue with anything regarding the restaurant, you need to speak to a manager first, or when that bill arrives, ask to speak to the manager.
And what if the service is indeed bad?
If the service is bad, you still speak to a manager, but I would still advocate leaving that 15% tip. I might not go above and leave a 20% tip. I certainly wouldn't be leaving a 25% tip, but I would leave a 15% tip, and I would speak to the manager and let them know that, you know, you're still leaving your 15%, but you're really not happy with it, and you don't think it was worth it, and you're probably going to go somewhere else next time.
And the final question I have, because I want to be on time here, I want to have good etiquette.
Thank you. I'm so sorry.
No, my fault. No, the final question is, where does this come from? Where do you get your etiquette from to give other people?
These tiny little fairies whisper it to us in a strange language in the middle of the night. No, our etiquette is derived from the principles of consideration, respect, and honesty, and we have sort of a process that we walk through, and whenever a new area of etiquette comes into play, we both use our process, and we actually really look at how Americans are interacting with this new etiquette area. So cell phones and social media are such a fabulous example. They did not exist in Emily's day. They did not exist when my Aunt Peggy took over the business. Actually, they might have existed, but they certainly weren't ubiquitous. And so we really look at how people are interacting with these devices or services or situations, and apply consideration, respect, and honesty to the different scenarios we get asked about or that we see people coming encounter with. So developing that section of etiquette, especially when we add it to like a new edition, like we just came out with the 19th edition of Emily Post's etiquette, and anytime there is new etiquette that needs to be explored, we really think about how are people interacting with this area, and what are the things you should look out for if you've never experienced it? What are the things you should look out for if you're experiencing problems with it? How can you be successful with it?
What should people do if they'd like to get a copy of this book?
Oh, well, we are definitely on Amazon. You can also purchase it through emilypost.com. We are just so thrilled that people are still actively interested and engaged. Our podcast, Awesome Etiquette, people write in with the most fabulous questions that you would never think of as being etiquette questions, and they turn out to be wonderful etiquette questions that have great solutions. And it's a great audience over there. They contribute. They speak up. It's really interesting conversation about etiquette.
It's fascinating. Lizzie Post, the great-granddaughter of Emily Post, the granddame of etiquette. I hope you can come back soon and we can maybe have a little more time and
explore. I would love a chance to redeem myself and start out without an apology. I'm so sorry about that again.
No. It was an absolute pleasure, and I do hope we get to talk again soon. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you. Have a lovely day.
Bye-bye. Lizzie Post, the great-granddaughter of Emily Post. Well, now you know. Everybody listening to this program who goes out tonight in Marion, Ohio, will have proper etiquette when they go to the restaurant, when they tip, when they email, when they use their cell phone, when they do whatever they do. We've got about 30 minutes left in the program, so if anybody wants to comment or question on anybody we've had on today, Ohio Democratic Chairman David Pepper or Tanner Hale, who was on earlier on, or Lizzie Post, or anything else going on in the world. I know there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the world. Give us a call, 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. I think right now a lot of the television is being dominated by the O.J. Simpson parole hearing. I haven't heard if he will get parole or will not get parole. I have not seen that yet. But if you have anything you want to bring to the program, 743-839-944, and we will discuss it, because that's what we do. Remember, we also do stream live on the internet, wwgh1071.com, and you can get us on any mobile device by searching the TuneIn app. You got to get the TuneIn app. It's free. Download the TuneIn app and then search WWGH. And that is how it all happens. That's how you get on the air here. And earlier on, we were having a conversation with Tanner Hale, who ran for city council here in Marion a few years ago, only lost by 4 votes. And we love to have him on from time to time to talk about the political world. And we were in mid-conversation last hour, so we'll get another moment here to talk with Tanner and finish up the discussion. Tanner, when we left off last hour, we were on the assumption that President Trump may be impeached or leave office. And what should happen with Hillary Clinton? You've had a little bit of time to think about it. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was certainly an interesting question that you had to ask me, and I think if we hit that dilemma, we're certainly going to be spending a lot of time pondering upon it. While I still think that there was an injustice, I'm still uncertain on the constitutionality of what would happen. I think, again, that protecting the constitutional infrastructure is more important than anything, and if there is a decision that we don't like as a country, we can know that it would only be temporary, because I don't assume that Trump would be impeached or that he would resign any time within the next year and a half or so. So that would leave us about 2 years to or so until the next election. And there was a placeholder that had to come through for the next 2 years. We would all certainly have to understand that. But again, I think the constitutional infrastructure would make it kind of hard to bring in Hillary Clinton. But I think it really is a question we have to wage across America.
Well, here's something interesting, because Mueller, who's investigating the collusion right now, Trump says if he gets involved in his personal finances that he would let him go. Now, what if he would do that? Where would we be then?
We would be filing an article of impeachment. We have no choice at that point. We are hitting the same thing that Nixon did back when he was president. That would just be an absolute nightmare. And all of his White House aides have tried to talk some sense to the president, saying, you can't do this. You cannot fire the special prosecutor. No matter how much you think it warrants it or not, you are not going to convince the American public that you fired them because they weren't doing a good job when they were investigating you. It implies guilt. It implies that he has something to hide. And the Dems have already come forward and said, we are filing an article of impeachment if he fires the special prosecutor. It is just that simple.
Well, it's interesting because 3 hours ago, Robert Mueller, who's doing the investigating here, has expanded his Russian probe to Trump business transactions, a source says. And Donald Trump, President Trump, said this morning that if he does that, he will fire him. So who's going to blink first here?
At the end of the day, I think that, you know, we have to trust Mueller. We have to respect that he's a special prosecutor that was assigned by his attorney general's office to ensure that we have a fair and concise investigation conducted. And at the end of the day, the Democrats, they have stayed out of this every time there hasn't been new information put forward. They've continued to let the investigators, you know, conduct this. And even the Republicans have expressed the desire to get this investigation completed, see what the facts are at the end of it, and we'll assess the situation when the investigation concludes. But I'm sure people listening certainly can probably concur that the president of the United States not only fires the FBI director investigating him, but fires the special prosecutor. There is reasons to believe that not only is he abusing his power and that he's obstructing justice, but he is hiding something. There is something that the investigators may tap into that he doesn't want the public to know about. And that should be extremely alarming. No one likes for investigators to get all up into their business, no pun intended. But this is a real crisis if the President of the United States fires the special prosecutor when we now know that the investigation is certainly expanding. I think you can tell by the scope of this investigation that they're finding information that could be incriminating to the president. Again, as far as collusion goes, we're at the basis right now that Trump, we have no evidence that Donald Trump himself knew, but we do have basis to say that he obstructed justice. If he does this, I think it's just the cherry on top of the cake.
Well, don't you think it's odd that he gives this interview, President Trump, to the New York Times, and he says he will not rule out firing Mueller? And he said that investigating his family's finances would cross a line. And we find out today from sources that Mueller might be doing that. Now, knowing what we know about President Trump, when he says don't do something and somebody does it, what normally happens?
They retaliate.
So if you know, this is just this morning. If that would happen, you believe that the Republicans, because it would take them as well, would try to impeach President Trump?
I think it would take some time. So let's go ahead and put ourselves in the situation. Mueller has expanded himself into the business portion of the investigation. Donald Trump moves forward and fires him. What I expect the Republicans to do is they'll sit on the information for at least 2 or 3 days. And they'll assess public opinions. There will be polls running all over the place. They will see the talking points, and they will better understand the dilemma they're in. They're on eggshells. They don't want to alienate the president, but they sure don't want to stand by his side right now either. But again, they're going to tug the party line before they condemn the party line. But if we hit the point where, let's go back to the situation, Trump fires the special prosecutor, the public is going to be in an uproar. I mean, I think it's going to be fired the FBI director, but on steroids, as far as how the public is going to perceive this. And the public absolutely hated the FBI director. And that was more easy to smooth over politically than firing over the man who's specifically designed to investigate the president. I think the Republicans will sit on the information, and they will see that the public is outraged, and they will start condemning the president. The Democrats are going to have to move forward with an articles of impeachment. There's just no choice at this point. And the Republicans, they don't need all of them. They just need a few. They just need, 24 or 25? And they have their majority, and it gets sent to the Senate. Now, unless we really, really hit a level of public uproar, I don't have any reason to believe that Donald Trump would be convicted in the Senate yet. But it's certainly plausible. I mean, a lot of people probably never assumed Nixon would have had the votes to convict him either, but there were the votes in place. So I do believe that Donald Trump wouldn't ever have to face conviction. I think that he would ultimately resign if public opinion tanked that much. And it's a constitutional crisis from there.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Next week, and this is going to be a big thing, testifying under oath will be Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort, all testifying under oath. Now, we all know from history that the only president to be impeached in the last 100 years was Bill Clinton, and that's because he lied under oath. All three of these people who have said things at times not to be true will be testifying under oath next week. Is that a problem?
If I were a Trump supporter, I'd be nervous because we already saw with Donald Trump Jr. that he has changed the story multiple times. Paul Manafort has shown an indication across the last year that he has not been completely honest about his relationship with Russia, his relationship with his work when he was a lobbyist lobbying for pro-Russian legislation in Ukraine. And, Jared Kushner, he's lied several times on his security clearance forms. You have many people in the public all across the nation that want to see Jared Kushner's security clearances revoked. And I think that they should. I think that he had an obligation when he was first being introduced into a position to get those security clearances to release that information. But it's just a continuing and troubling pattern we've seen this entire time where they withhold information, they don't talk about it, they lie about it, they don't share that information with the public until they're brought with overwhelming evidence that refutes what they were saying, and then they confess. And then they establish talking points to downplay it. I mean, this is what happened with the Donald Trump Jr. meeting. It turned into about the Russian adoption. Then it turned into, I know that she was a lawyer, but it's not wrong to get some, it's not wrong to talk to a foreign government. And then it's turned into, it's just opposition research. It's not an issue. But it's clear as day that they were withholding that information because they knew they had something to hide. So that's the dilemma we're in right now. And I'm extremely anxious. I think that Mueller is getting a lot better understanding of where the investigation is, where it's headed. And I don't think it's diminishing anytime soon. If anything, it's expanding. This is nothing like the Hillary Clinton email investigation. We are hitting a level in this investigation that is just beyond anything we could have possibly imagined. I mean, if you would have told me 7 months ago that the President of the United States would be on the brink of impeachment, I would have said, you're ludicrous. You're crazy. That's just partisan hogwash. But no, this is the legitimate reality we're in.
And today is his anniversary of 6 months in office.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, can you imagine? It's only been 6 months.
It seems like we've just been on. It just seems like we've been on this roller coaster ever since then. Where, I just have this feeling that all across this country, that we haven't really understood exactly how to handle some of the things we're seeing. The consistent lies out of the administration. I mean, we're even dealing with a dilemma in Ohio, where the vice president of the United States is making false claims about Ohio's Medicaid. And the governor's office and many state legislators have to step up and say, no, what you're saying is wrong. What you're saying is a downright lie. It's not a spin. It's not the partisan talking points. It's a lie. It is absolutely not factual, and that's what's so frustrating.
For people who don't know, what did the vice president say about Medicaid in Ohio?
Well, what was going on with Mike Pence is, and you know, Mike Pence is actually going to be in Columbus this weekend, and he's going to do a rally with Senator Portman. He's continuing to further the narrative that Medicaid is going to be strengthened under this legislation, and obviously he's been very critical of Governor Kasich, although that Mike Pence, when he was governor, he expanded Medicaid himself, and for rightful reasons. But this narrative that he continues to push, that under this Senate plan, it's going to continue to strengthen Medicaid, it's going to power in consumers, it is the absolute opposite of what the CBO has concluded, what every single budget and management office has been able to conclude. And this is what's utterly frustrating.
What do you say to people who say the media and everybody is just out to get Donald Trump? Why don't they leave him alone and let him do his job?
Well, that's an extremely important issue that I've constantly been mindful of this entire administration, is the attack on media and journalists. I think this is one of the more difficult administrations they've ever had to encounter, of dealing with, you know, the press dealing with this administration. It's got to be frustrating, and I empathize to all people in the media who value the work they do, the integrity that goes into being a journalist. And I think that I think this warrants a time where we have to really sit down as people and understand what the media's job is. Their job is elected accountable. Their job is to ask the questions that the American people don't have the access to do. And sure, are journalists pushy, and do they speculate, and do they ask questions that bother you? Absolutely. You yourself, have you ever asked me a question that I'm like, geez, like, come on? Of course. But at the end of the day, I understand that it's the media's job to hold people accountable, to ask the tough questions, because that's the beauty of freedom of the press. That's the beauty of having journalists in place to be able to ask these tough questions so that there is some sense of accountability within. And as we discussed on the previous hour, where they're having press briefings and not even making them open to the public, that, I don't know. It's beyond anything I could have ever imagined. To me, if I was president, I would have never imagined that I could authorize a press briefing that was closed to the public. And I think that it's a continuing pattern of them continuing to hold information that isn't wanting to be going to the rest of the public. And it's really, really troubling.
What do you say to the people who say people did not get who they wanted in there? They wanted their girl Hillary in there, and that she didn't get in there is what this is all about. If they couldn't get her in elected, they're going to push her in by getting Trump out. I've heard that.
Yeah, well, and to really to better answer your question about the media narrative and pushing this narrative that the media is just out to get him, not only do I think that comes down to not understanding what journalists' jobs are, but I think it is the consistent effort of this administration to undermine what journalists' jobs are and to make the American public not trust the media. At the end of the day, we are replacing facts with propaganda. What the White House is spewing when they say that the legislation they're putting forward is to strengthen Medicaid, when we all know it's gutting Medicaid, when they say that it's going to make insurance more affordable, when every budget management institution has already come forward and said, no, what your plan does is make it harder for people to get on insurance, that's propaganda. Those are lies. That isn't fake news. That isn't the left-wing media out to get Donald Trump. It's propaganda to make these false claims. And at the end of the day, it is really pushing people to emphasize the concept of the ends justify the means. I don't care how much I have to lie. I don't care how much I have to spend this. I don't care how much we have to mislead. We can just continue to say what we want, and my base is going to support me. I think this is a really interesting political strategy by the White House to say, hey, we don't need Democrats to like us. We do not need independent voters to really like us. All we have to do is keep the base. And what we were able to conclude is while Donald Trump has low approval ratings, Republicans are disgusted with the media. Republicans, 96% of Trump supporters said that they would support him again. So their political strategy, by their design, in a sense, is working. They're keeping the base. And part of keeping that base is undermining what journalists' jobs are and to make the public have a distrust for media.
Here in Ohio next year, we will have a new governor. John Kasich will be out due to term limits. And on the Republican side, we have some heavy hitters already. Three of the four. One's the Secretary of State, John Husted. We have Attorney General Mike DeWine and Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor. Where do you see that Republican primary going?
As far as the Republican primary, and another person that's in the race is Congressman Jim Renacci. And if you want my opinion, I think Jim Renacci is going to win the nomination. It may not seem clear as day right now, but within the Ohio Republican Party circle, I think that they like Jim Renacci the most. I think that they certainly are backing him and that they're moving all resources without coming out because they can't get involved in the primaries. But I think it's clear who they want. I think that President Trump is going to come out and endorse Jim Renacci. And I think this is why Jim Renacci has followed almost to a T Donald Trump's talking points, because I think that that's where the direction of this race is moving. As far as the Democrat side, you know, we've already had Joe Schiavone show up in Marion and answer questions and make a presence known to try to move his campaign. He's the Senate Minority Leader in the State Senate. And there's also Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. The race is still very
Betty Sutton clear. Is out there.
And Betty Sutton and Connie Pillich is running as well. And the race is still very uncertain on the Democratic side. And there's been a lot of speculation that maybe Richard Cordray is going to enter the race soon. I have a gut feeling he is going to enter the race. And when that happens, I think that we'll start seeing a more clear race, because I think that Richard Cordray would be the nominee. But as far as the Republican side, I'm not sure what this is going to spell. While it looks like it's going to be a nastier race, that's what they said last year for the 2016 presidential race. That was a nastier primary, and when it came down to it, the Republican voters ended up aligning, and they supported Donald Trump. And they very well could do the same thing in Ohio for the governor's race. So I'm not 100% sure.
Do you think Renacci, because I would say he has the lowest name ID of the four, Mary Taylor, Mike DeWine, and John Husted. Do you think What is unique about him that in the debates that will happen, that in the campaigning, because the front runner right now, people say, is Mike DeWine. What's going to change that?
Well, yeah, while Mike DeWine's ID is the highest, and understanding Renace's place in this race is very important, because right off the page, it doesn't look right now that he's jumping off. But as this campaign starts to unfold, as we get into the fall months, as we continue to have more understanding of what they're raising money, Jim Renace is raising money. Jim Renace follows the talking points. A lot of staffers that worked on the Trump campaign and the RNC side of the Trump campaign are getting on Renace's campaign. His staff is growing. They're building. They're moving across the state. And most notably, his talking points are very similar to what the talking points are now. It's very unclear what Husted's stance is on Medicaid. Mike DeWine's stance on Medicaid is unclear. Mary Taylor's stance on Medicaid is very similar to John Kasich's, which isn't popular among Republicans. Renace has condemned the Medicaid expansion. He supported repealing Obamacare and replacing in the manner that they were trying to do in the House under the American Health Care Act. And he supported the Better Reconciliation Act, which is the Senate versions of the health care plan. And as we continue to move forward, I think the support is going to start lining up behind Renace. Money is important, and Renace is certainly raising it, but you have to look where the train is moving. And Renace's campaign is building steam. I don't want him to win the nomination. I think that he would be an absolute atrocity as a governor, but I really do believe that he's going to end up winning the nomination. I think that's also contingent on if President Trump endorses, and I think he will.
Well, here's the problem, though, in the last 3 minutes we have. If Renace does get the nomination and he favors Medicaid reduction, would it be easier for a Democrat to win if he does get the nomination?
I don't know. That's the troubling thing is, we have no idea how the electorate is going to respond in 2018. We're being mindful of this Russia investigation as well, because it's very unclear what we're going to see out of the electorate. A lot of people assume it's going to be more favor towards the Democrats, but the Republicans, while the special elections, in my opinion, don't hold any weight because they were all Republican districts anyways, and they should have won all of them anyways. But I think we're going to see a slight tilt towards the Dems, but I just don't know if it's able to overcome in 2018 to win statewide across of Ohio. So that's really where the fireworks are going to go off, is understanding how the electorate is going to respond nationwide. And when we have a better understanding of how it's going to act nationwide, we'll know better what they're going to act like in Ohio. Because outside of Florida, I don't think there's a more important state as far as elections than Ohio.
When it comes down to it, how do you see the Congress and the Senate going? Is Sherrod Brown in trouble in his next election?
I don't believe Sherrod Brown's in trouble.
Nationally, where do you see the House and the Senate going?
I think the Dems pick up seats, but I don't think it's enough to win the House. I think that the Dems have a 0% chance of winning the Senate in 2018. It's not plausible. There's just the way that they're structured. The Dems are on defense in a lot of states, that even if they do manage to pull out, I just don't know if there's enough Senate races for them to overcome and win the majority. Especially, they get held back because two members that caucus with them are not even Democrats themselves, and Bernie Sanders and Angus King from Maine. This is where we're going to look on, and I think it's going to send a very powerful message to the administration that the American people are tired of seeing the lies. They're sick of the policies that aren't being implemented. Some Republican voters may be tired of the Republicans not doing what they promised. And at the end of the day, Donald Trump has not signed any major piece of legislation. So I think the ineffective card is going to be used nationwide. But it's going to be really, really interesting to see what's going to end up happening. I don't think the Dems are going to change the power in either one of the chambers, but if they prove me wrong, I'll be the first one to admit I was wrong.
Tanner Hale, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Tanner Hale, always enjoyable. If anybody wants to call in, we have about a minute left. 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. But we do want to thank all of our guests today. Democratic Chairman of the State of Ohio, David Pepper. The great-granddaughter of Emily Post, Lizzie Post, and Tanner Hale, who ran for city council here in Marion 2 years ago and lost by 4 votes. 19 years old at the time. I think getting close to 21 or 21 right now. That's all the time we have today. We will be back tomorrow with the Exchange Club at 12 o'clock and the Faye Bank Charlie Evers Show, 1:10 to 3 p.m. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Without a doubt, but I'm not sure you have it exactly right.
What did I have incorrect? I want to be correct with this.